Hey, back again. All right, let me get the mic. Why was this mic pushed down before? Okay, there we go. Now it's... How's it sound? Yeah? Level's good? Yeah? Okay, cool. All right, well, let's just do this thing. I'm psyched. Gonna have fun today. Reggie in the booth. Levels look good. Look good in here. All right, thumbs up. Let's just get going. All right, we're all set. Yeah. Three S's. Star, smile, strong. Here we go. Three, two. Oh. No, guys. You got to wait until after I say. You know the drill. Come on. What do you got? A quick trigger finger there? Let's try it again. Okay, here we go. Serious now. Three, two, one. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted online for your podcasting pleasure. Not only at WGNplus.com, but wherever you download or find your favorite podcasts. We are certainly appreciative of your loyalty. And don't forget, wherever it is that you do find those podcasts, don't be afraid to subscribe to those platforms, to rate this podcast, and by all means, pass them on. Pass the good word on to your friends, because word of mouth is also something that helps in the podcasting world to spread the wealth. So by all means, tell your friends if you enjoy this podcast. And if you enjoy this podcast, you can go to WGNplus.com, where I have a landing page. And you go to the entertainment section, and there is a prompt there that says Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And you can find all previous 173 episodes. So you can catch up. Talk about binging. Now, that's more than 3 years worth. You got 3 years to do nothing? But it also means one thing. If there's 173 episodes back there in the vaults, then that means that this is episode 174. So welcome. Good day, eh? Good welcome to episode 174. Oh, jeez. You hosers. Elton Jim with you today. Later on in the show, we will be talking to Emily Arminetti in the Pop Culture Club segment, and we will be discussing the recent controversy about a new Saturday Night Live cast member who just may have had the shortest stint on the show in history. We'll have to look that up. I'm not sure, but it may have been. He was announced as a new cast member, and a few days later, he was embroiled in some controversy, which led to him being fired before he ever stepped on the stage, before he ever, in person, either heard or uttered those words, live from New York at Saturday night. He was gone. So we'll talk about all of the issues that were surrounding that interesting moment, and certainly was a pop culture headline. But before that, I wanted to discuss something that I always find interesting. Born and raised here in the Chicago area, in Chicago, still live in the Chicago area, have my entire life. And one thing that I continually find interesting is the amazing loyalty and blind faith in the sports teams in this city. And it is both an amazing, I use that word a lot. I apologize. It's an admirable attribute to have such a dyed-in-the-wool, die-hard loyalty to sports teams. And Chicago has it. But it's also been a curse. because inevitably the teams have disappointed their fans more than they have delighted them in the last 200 years or however how long sports has been going on. But there's no question that Chicago is one of the great sports cities. And I say that not just because I've lived here and have experienced it myself, but I have traveled to many different cities and I have attended sporting events, all different kinds of sporting events, baseball games, football games, hockey games in different cities and major cities like New York and Philadelphia and Los Angeles and Detroit. And, you know, as I said, some of the major Boston, you know, some of the major cities that certainly are known for their fanatic fans and their deep sports histories and legacies. And I have to say that based on what I have observed, just being in the stands during a game, you know, there is a unique aspect to the Chicago fan. And, you know, I have been a sports fan since a little kid. Long before I was Elton Jim, I was Sporting Jim. I was quite active in sports as a young child. And even well into my adult years, I continued to play different sports in different leagues. But so I've always been very athletic and active in things. So obviously I became a sports fan as well as a participant from a young age. And I've said a few times here that before my bedroom when I was a little kid was plastered with Elton John posters on the ceilings, on the walls. Yes, even on the drapes and on the headboards and on the side of the mirrors and on the outside and the insides of the furniture. Anywhere you could put a picture, I'd put one of Elton. But before that, my bedroom was decorated with sporting things and sports figures. I had sports pennants of the Cubs and the Bears and the Blackhawks and pictures of my favorite Blackhawks, like Tony Esposito and Keith Magnuson and Stan Mikita and Bobby Hull and posters of Dick Butkus from Chicago Bears and Ron Santo. So and baseballs and you know, like I said, pennants and you name it. And then 1973, all that kind of changed, and I slowly began to transition. In terms of I still love sports and still played sports. You know, as I said, I played baseball throughout my high school years, and I played football for a couple of years, and I played a hockey, both ice and floor hockey, into my 30s. So I continued to play sports, and I played basketball in grammar school and in high school for a couple of years, too. So I was certainly very active in sports. And so, yes, I've been a sports fan for most of my life, and but at the same time, I certainly have built up a thick skin, but I've always been skeptical of blind faith in anything. You know, my career in the media has been more than 30 years from when I was still in college. I started to write a music column. So I've sort of been trained in looking at things more objectively than subjectively, and always with a little hint of skepticism and cynicism, because ultimately that's what you are trained to do to become a journalist. You have to be able to separate your own, at least you should, at least in my mind you should. You have to learn how to separate your own interests and your own opinion and your own potential biases for the sake of the objective reporting of the event. Now, if you are a columnist, you are paid for your opinion, and so you don't need to do that. And initially, as I said, I was a music columnist, so my opinion was what was asked for. And so I would say, I like this, I don't like that, or I would tell a story from my subjective view, which is fine, as well as pepper it with some objective facts. But as I went on in my career, I became a street reporter for newspapers, and later an editor for newspapers, and later an editor in magazines. And so then I did have to be objective in my view of things. And so that does sort of, you know, that does set a reporter aside from the average person who doesn't have those internal demands, because you can't turn on and turn off that kind of skepticism or cynicism. Once you begin to develop that and look at things from that point of view, it's hard to separate that from your personal life and your professional life. So you become something of a skeptic, something of a cynic, something of more of an objective view of things than a subjective view. And certainly through that, I realize that I probably have inadvertently sacrificed the thrill and the excitement of pure fandom. I mean, even with someone like Elton John or Bruce Springsteen, or someone who I have great respect for and admiration for as an artist, and their music and their art has played a major role in my life, I have always been objective, even about them. There's no question. I will wax poetic, and I will use the most flowery and flattering language when there's anyone that I like. I will certainly, probably go overboard, or at least hopefully provide some unique insights about the people and the artists that I like that have, influenced me in my life. But at the same time, I will be objective. I don't believe everything they do is great. And some fans, whether it's sports fans or music fans or whatever they are fans of, they don't see the downside in their idols at all or their sports teams. They refuse to see it. They, as I said before, they have this blind faith. And I guess in some ways I envy that, because that must be a very liberating and freeing kind of perspective to have. And it is exciting and it is fun. And I understand that when I watch people on television or at a sporting event and they're all dressed up, you know, with the jerseys and the hats and the face paint and the signs, and they're screaming and they're literally living and dying with every pitch or every snap of a football or every shot of a puck or every block of a basketball. I have, there are some people that are just so dedicated, as I said before, just so blindly, loyal that they live and breathe this stuff. And there is nothing can be said that is negative. They won't accept it. As I said, I've always been a little skeptical of that. And maybe that comes from my own mindset, or maybe it comes from my professional training as a member of the media. I'm not sure, but it certainly does give me a different perspective. And a lot of people don't like to be around that devil's advocate perspective that I sometimes can provide. I'll be watching a football game or a baseball game or whatever, and I'll call it for what it is. If my team is playing bad, some people's mind, if it's their team, it's like here we come. Oh, they're always waiting for that neck. That they're always looking at it from an optimistic view, and I'm always looking from it from a very realistic view. And a lot of times, diehard fans don't want to deal with realism. They don't want to hear that. You know, sports fans especially are very superstitious, as we all know. They'll wear the same thing, sit in the same seats, eat the same foods. Even like somehow, I mean, it's just really funny how they, you know, talk about how self-centric we are as humans. We actually believe that we personally are doing something that somehow cosmically is affecting the outcome and is affecting the performance of this other group of people. I mean, think about that. Now, once again, exactly. What I've just done there is provide you with a realistic, objective view of a sports fan's superstition. If you talk to a real diehard sports fan, they will look at you like, what are you out of your mind? Why would you even think of dissecting it that way? Of course I have. This is my team, and every time I do this, they win. It's hard to combat that, right? There's I've learned through my life, and I've learned through the way people have reacted to me, and it is true. There's two things you don't really talk about, maybe three: sports, politics, and religion. It is best to stay away from those because there are some people on either side, and I'm not condemning either side. As I said, I wish I had that ability of blind faith. It must be very reassuring, and it must be very easy to make sense of things. But I don't have that kind of blind faith in things like that. And so I am always looking at it from a very realistic point of view, and that has gotten me in trouble in my life, and I guess it's just part of who I am, and I have to accept that. I don't mean to do it. I'm not trying to put anybody down or, look at somebody lesser because they do have that. As I said, many times I'm ultimately a little jealous that they do have it. I wish I had that ability, but I don't. I always kind of look at things from both sides, with more objective than subjective. In fact, one point, I'll never forget, and I didn't find this out for years, but a very good friend of mine, when I was from high school, who's still a friend of mine, 40-some years later, but little did I know that one night I went to watch a Chicago Bears game with him and his family and a bunch of friends, and we were at their house, and his dad was there, and his dad was a diehard Bear fan. And some of you may remember, this goes back several years, during the great 1980s Bears teams. And in 1986, the Bears, I believe, lost one game. And the one game that they lost was on Monday Night Football to the Miami Dolphins. And the Bears were rolling at the time. They were clearly the cream of the NFL. And they were playing a very good team, Dan Marino and the Miami Dolphins, a good team, not a great team. But certainly when you play Dan Marino, who is a Hall of Fame quarterback, you're going to be in for something. And so there was the game. And it was clear, if anybody remembers this game, on Monday Night Football, it was very clear that the Bears just, for whatever reason, even though they were steamrolling over all of their opponents that season, this day they just did not have it on either side, defense or offense. It was just very clear from the beginning. They were playing lackluster. The defense wasn't as tenacious as it used to be. The offense was faltering. It never caught a rhythm. And it was very clear from the outset of the game, because that season, from the first snap, the Bears had been dominant. And this was glaring how different they were playing on this game for some reason. And of course, it was in Miami, so the Dolphins were at home. They had that kind of advantage, and they certainly took advantage of the Bears not being, for whatever reason, at the top of their game, and Miami ultimately lost. or Miami ultimately won, and the Bears, you know, was their only loss of the season. And they looked really bad. They just really looked bad. And then they went, the next week they were fine. But for whatever reason, that day they were bad. So we're at the house, and we're, you know, we're watching the game, and we're, you know, having snacks and the whole thing. And so, you know, you could see at the beginning of the game, they were just off their rhythm. And so I was saying, oh my God, this is not from the very, you know, from the first, you know, few minutes of the game, I said, well, I don't know. This doesn't look good. They just look off tonight. And as the game progressed, they were off. And I found this out 30 years later, because I was just stating the obvious in my mind. But being in a room filled with diehard Bear fans, there were some people, especially my friend's father, and I was in my early 20s at the time, you know, 21, 22 years old. He was looking at me as if I really was affecting the outcome of this game by my, in his mind, negativity. You know, I wasn't rooting one way or the other. I was just kind of saying, wow, they look bad tonight. Boy, they don't look good, you know. And that they just weren't used to hearing that, because they were diehard Bear fans. And so it was always about, they'll come back. And it was very clear to anyone looking at this from an objective view that the Bears were not going to win this game. It was painfully clear from almost the get-go. And I was just expressing that. I wasn't trying to be right or wrong. I wasn't trying to jinx anybody, because that wasn't even in my mind. But that was the way my comments were being viewed by his father. And little did I know that after that game, after I left, he told my friend that I should never be invited over again to watch a Bears game. And I never was. And I never thought about it, really, but I never was. And I always felt, but I was invited over to the house on other occasions for other things, but I did notice that there was always this little distance between him and me, and I never really put two and two together, because in my mind, what I was doing, I wasn't doing anything right or wrong. I was just commenting on the game. But for a diehard fan, you know, you're either with us or against us. That's kind of the way it is. And I finally found out about it 30 some years later, and I was shocked, and we laughed about it. But you know, for three decades, that was the edict. So, yeah, I guess my objectivity at times is has played a role in some relationships. But what can I say? That's who I am. I look at sports fans with an interesting eye, and especially diehard sports fans. And so I bring this up in terms of my view, because here we are, and I should say that I do record this podcast a few days before it is posted. So just so you know, for instance, I am recording this podcast on September 18th, okay? And it will be posted on the 23rd. So it's 5 days from now. So as I speak right now, I certainly can't predict the future. So so I want to do this because it'll be very interesting to see what happens from when I am recording this to when you actually hear it. What I'm talking about will either be proven or disproven, which I think is kind of fun and interesting. So that's why I decided to do this. But I have to say that right now we are in the throes of the end of the baseball season and the beginning of the football season. And ultimately, Chicago, you can debate this all you want. But ultimately, Chicago is a Bears town and a Cubs town. There certainly are fans of the White Sox. There are certainly fans of the Bulls in basketball. And there are certainly fans, and a huge number of fans now in the last several years, of the Blackhawks after their recent success in winning 3 Stanley Cups. No question, those sports and those teams have large and rabid and loyal, followings of their own fans. No question. But when all is said and done, this city in the sports world lives and dies by the Cubs and the Bears. And now even that comment, I'm sure, will anger some people who are listening. But that's the truth. That's the truth. In baseball season, it's a Cubs town. And when football season happens in early September through January now, it is Bears time. Every weekend and every day leading up to it really is the Bears from a sports angle. So we find ourselves on September 18th, as I record this, at an interesting time for both of these. The Bears started the season, and over this last offseason, even though they were unceremoniously eliminated from the playoffs last year with the infamous double doink, the missed field goal in the last second against the Philadelphia Eagles in the first round of the playoffs. But there was great enthusiasm all summer. They were 12-4 last year, and there was great anticipation and great expectation for the team. The quarterback would have a new year, another year under the system, of learning the system. The Bears' defense was hugely dominant, and so there were, in no uncertain terms, huge expectations for the Bears coming into the 2019 season. And the expectation was not just success, but it was Super Bowl. And the Bear fans always immediately go right to the Super Bowl. If they win 2 or 3 games in a row, they're going to the Super Bowl. That's just the way Bears fans are. Because they're rabid. They're rabid fans. They love the Bears. And let's don't forget, you know, football is an interesting dynamic because there are only 16 games. So every game is important. Every game, it's one game a week. Friends and families converge. They get together. They wear their jerseys. They have special foods that they eat. There's traditions revolving around it. There's superstitions revolving around it. It really is. Football is unique. You know, baseball, there's 162 games. And basketball and hockey, there's 80-some games. But football, there's only 16 games once a weekend. It is an event type of sport. And so that is another reason why I think people are so rabid about football and about the Bears here in Chicago, is just because innately it sets it up. There's this one game a week. So you look forward to that game, and then you have all your traditions and your friends and your foods. And so it's really a social event every week as much as it is a sporting event. And that's why it becomes so ingrained in people from a young age, because it's like a family tradition. Most Bear fans and Cub fans, it is a family tradition, because it these games are social events as well as sporting events in many cases. So it's great expectations for the Bears. I enjoy when the Bears are playing well. I enjoy it, and when the Bears won in '85, that great season, it was an amazing thing to watch every week. They were so good and so dominant and so fun to watch. So I enjoyed that, but as I said, I also have to call them like I see them. And sadly, over the last 30 some years, the Bears have not been all that good. And I have seen a lot of troubling trends that have come to be true, that Bear fans at the time do not want to admit to or recognize, because they're in the throes of this great optimism that they have for the team. And then later on, they'll look back and say, oh, yeah, that was terrible. But at the moment, they really couldn't see it. They're blinded by their faith in the team and their optimism for the team. And so here I come, the big pin in the balloon to pop the... And I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer. I don't mean to do this, but I also believe that the only way to be successful and to be truly good is to admit your faults, admit your shortcomings, and work on those to change the course, identify the problem, and fix it. But a lot of sports fans, a lot of Bear fans, don't want to see the problems. They would rather hope that things will get better, even though there's times when they just won't. It just isn't going to happen. And that's why they haven't won a Super Bowl in, 35 years. Almost. And they were only at one, and that was almost a waste of time to even be in that Super Bowl. What was that, back in 2009? I mean, aside from the first play of the game, when Devin Hester ran the ball back for a touchdown, the Bears were never in that game against the Colts. It's almost embarrassing. Yes, it's good to be there, but I don't know if they really deserve to be in that Super Bowl. And the outcome proved it. And Bear fans didn't want to hear that. So when I looked at the Bears this year, I didn't really see how the heck, after last year being eliminated in the first round, I felt that they won a lot of games because their defense helped carry the team. The offense really didn't. So while they were 12-4, I really felt that 12-4 record was a mirage. I didn't think it was real. I think they were more of an 8-8 team. And that's exactly how they played in that first round of the playoffs, and that's why they lost. If they were a 12-4 team, they would have dusted the Philadelphia Eagles off the field long before the last second to miss that field goal. The Bears were probably an 8-8 or a 9-7 team. Good, not great. Not 12-4. 12-4 is Super Bowl caliber. They were not Super Bowl caliber. But the record was the record. And so there was this great optimism. But then I looked, so I saw them, how bad they played at the last game of the season. And I looked at their new schedule, that they now would have a first place schedule because they came in first place, so your schedule gets more difficult. And so I looked at their schedule and their opponents objectively, and I told a few friends, didn't really say it publicly that much because I know how I would have been attacked, but in my mind I said the Bears are probably going to be 7-9. They have a losing record this year. And at best they'll be 8-8, which I thought they really were last year. They're going to play some tougher teams, and I just see them. I went game by game. I just didn't have this blanket view that, oh, the Bears are going to be 14-0. Let's look at the games they have to play. Once again, I'm looking at this logically. Are they going to beat this team? Probably not. Are they going to beat this team? Probably not. And I came up with 7-9. So as it stands right now, they have not played the Washington Redskins yet, but they pulled out a game. They are 1-1 on the record book right now. They pulled out an amazing win in the last second, literally the last second, in Denver last week. But to be honest with you, in all truth, they should have lost that game, and they really are 0-2. Now, the Redskins aren't very good, and so when this does post, the Bears are either 1-2 or 2-1. According to their schedule, according to their record. But I don't have a lot of high hopes for this team. And I think there's going to be a struggle all season. And I even wonder if they make the playoffs. But every week we see how fans and the media grasp on to whatever they can in a positive way to keep that going, that blind faith going. And good for them. But I usually don't get overly disappointed on things because I look at things from a more realistic standpoint. And look, I understand why there is such a interest in the Bears winning. I said to you before, this is a social gathering as well as a sporting gathering. This is a familial gathering. This is a generational gathering. This is in people's DNA. It is in their bloodlines. I get it. I understand. They get together with their families. It's all there. And don't forget, the Bears on a weekly basis are a revenue-generating entity. There are a lot of segments who depend on the Bears being good to create excitement. So that's why the excitement is there. The optimism is there. It's not just from the fans. It's all over the place. It's driven by the media. If the Bears do well, the newspapers sell more. So they will give you that propaganda of how good the Bears are going to be and create that optimism for as long as they can until it's obvious, because that helps sell papers. Enthusiastic Bear fans want to hear how good they are. So they'll buy more newspapers. They want to hear the good news of how good things are going to be. So the newspapers and the columnists and the writers are pushing the positive Bear story as much as they can. There's a vested interest in that. They're told to do that by their editors. I have no question about that, because some of these writers I know are too smart and too knowledgeable about the game to be putting forth some of the opinions that they are, unless I think they're being instructed to. Radio stations do well when the Bears are doing well. People call in. They want to talk about how great the game was and how great the next game is going to be. TV stations do well when the Bears are doing good. They get to cover more fans and everybody, there's this excitement. Restaurants and bars do well. Everybody's going out to watch a game at their favorite bar, their favorite restaurant. Grocery stores do well. If you don't go out to a restaurant or a bar, you stay at home and you create your favorite cheese dip. And so they do well. When you walk into a grocery store these days, right when you walk in, what will you see? The first thing, you will see beers and chips as the first thing you see in your grocery store. Guaranteed. Beer and chips. They're wanting you to stock up for the Bear game on Sunday. That's what it's all about. So there are a lot of vested interests in the Bears doing well until the season is so obvious. So right now, yes, the Bears won an incredibly lucky game with less than a second left. Exciting, crazy, topsy-turvy. But they really didn't deserve to win that game. That's just realistic. And so I don't really have a lot of great optimism for this team. But Bear fans will take that win and say Super Bowl. By the middle of November, we'll see what they say. And I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer. They just aren't that good of a team. They are not in the strata of a Super Bowl contender like the New England Patriots. They're just not. They're not there yet. Can they get there? Yes, they have a great defense, but their offense is lacking, and that's huge. If their defense doesn't score points for them or put their offense in good field position like they did last year, they're going to be 7-9 or worse. That's just fact. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is, and that's the way I look at it, and I can't help but say that out loud. So, Bear fans, I love you. As we speak, the Bears are right now either 1-2 and an unbelievably loss to the Redskins, or they beat the Redskins and right now they're 2-1 on their record books. And as we speak, all of Chicago is euphoric this morning and there is talk of the Super Bowl. All I can say is call me in November or December. And while we're talking about it quickly, who knows what's going to happen with the Cubs. As this podcast is posted, the Cubs just finished a four-game series with the first place St. Louis Cardinals. As it stands right now, the Cubs are either in first place, in the same place they were at the beginning, maybe one or two or three games out of first place with about a week to go, or they are 5 or 6 games out and they probably won't make the playoffs. I don't know where they're at, but you know now today, but I will make a prediction. I do believe, and I've been saying this for years, that the manager of the Cubs, Joe Maddon, will be fired at the end of the season. The only way he doesn't get fired is if the Cubs go to the World Series or come pretty close to it. But making the playoffs is not enough. The Cubs management expects to make the playoffs every year, which I love, that there's that expectation, and that's what they go for. And Joe Maddon, yes, he won a World Series, but... you know, Joel Quenneville won 3 Stanley Cups and he got fired. The Cubs have not played well since that World Series. Yes, they've won. They've come in first place. They won 95 games last year. They've made the playoffs, although they didn't make them last year. Made the playoffs in 2017, and maybe they'll make them this year by the skin of their teeth. But I wonder if they really will. They still play the Cardinals the last 3 games of this season next week. So wherever they are this week, they still might have a chance to pull it out. I'm hoping, because I am a Cub fan, I do root for them. But I also see their weaknesses, and I believe that their manager is one of their weaknesses. I think they've won in spite of their manager. Yes, he won the World Series for them, or helped them win, but I think they won in spite of him in that World Series, because I thought he made some crazy decisions, and I really don't agree with a lot of his on-field decisions. So I will go out on a limb on 2 things here. I think the Bears are going to be about 7-9, 8-8 at best, and probably will not make the playoffs this season. And I'm not sure what the Cubs are going to do. They may make the playoffs. They won't. If they do, they're not going to go deep. They will not go into the World Series, and I believe that Joe Maddon will be fired. I say that on September 18th. This podcast will be posted on September 23rd. And we'll see how I do. Go Cubs. Go Bears. And welcome back to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And now we take a stroll over to the Pop Culture Club with Emily Arminetti. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Jim.
Hey. So this week, we've had a little interesting pop culture kerfuffle that
yes.
has emerged, which is very interesting. And it involves Saturday Night Live, which I don't know if they're doing this to, you know, make some... headlines for the new 45th season, which is an amazing, milestone when you think about it. 45 years ago, geez,
yeah,
the show has been on, and it has never been off. It hasn't always been good, but it has never been off. So that's quite an achievement. But yeah, so they made the big announcement that they were going to have three new cast members, and they usually find these people, you know, out on the road, either stand-ups or parts of, comedy troupes like Second City in Chicago or the Groundlings in L.A. or things like that. The Citizens Brigade.
Yes.
And all these, comic troupes. And so, did you ever hear of this comedian named Shane Gillis?
Not until this whole,
Situation. Shane Gillis.
Where did he come
from? Yeah, and I've looked him up. He's like, what I love is Shane Gillis. We already have the question mark. They don't know whether he's 31 or 32, so he's already lying about his age.
Well, everyone in the business.
He hasn't even made it yet, and now, by all accounts, he's already not only made it, but he never will. And he's already lying about his age.
But curiously, just by 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I have to laugh because there was an actress who's achieved some amount of fame, Bonnie Hunt.
Well, she's a Chicagoan.
Yeah, Jumanji and a few other things. And she had her own show for a while. She was on Letterman quite a bit. He always liked her. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, she's from Chicago. And so she went to the high school that my wife went to. Mm-hmm. And she was a senior, or she may have already just graduated. My wife went to high school with Bonnie Hunt's sister. They were in the same grade, same year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what's always fun is that, so Bonnie Hunt is at least 4 years older than my wife.
Right.
We know this.
Right.
It's statistical.
It's just the facts.
It's just the fact. And so every year when they do celebrity birthdays,
right,
Bonnie Hunt is the same age as my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Miraculously, she has lost 4 years.
Right. Well, so I feel the same way. Like, it's usually when I'm reading, like, a magazine article about an actress, you know, and they always mention their age. I mean, they mention everyone's age, right, in any kind of article. You know, the age always is kind of near, somewhere near the beginning of the story or the first mention of the person. And there are certain, there's like a certain group of female actors, we'll say, who, like, somehow, like, when I was growing up and they were already acting, they were for sure at least 4 or 5 years older than I was.
Right, now they're younger.
Playing, they were playing, I was in high school and they were, like, playing adults in movies,
right,
you know? And usually it skews the other way, right? In Hollywood, it's like, you'll have, you know, like, let's say, take the cast of Beverly Hills 90210, for example. I mean, I think there were probably only maybe, there's probably only one person on that, in that main cast that was playing their actual age, you know,
right,
like everybody else was in their 20s playing high schoolers. So it's usually like that. And so anyway, there's this, like, a certain group of act, you know, female actors who, like, as we are in middle age now, suddenly they're like my age.
Right.
I'm like, wait a second.
Right.
No, Gwyneth Paltrow is not the same age.
I know. That's so funny. Like, yeah.
It's like they're shaving. It's like we're meeting. I'm getting older and they're like staying the same age.
I know.
And we're somehow now we're like, you know, next year I will be older.
Right.
You know, Gwyneth Paltrow, suddenly, magically, like, it's just, I don't know.
Well, I had to laugh. I'm reading a story about a new show that's coming on, and by this time, when this is posted, it will already been on, it will already premiere, I think. And we talked about it last week, the show with Patricia Heaton called Carol's Second Chance, I believe. You know, mm-hmm, and she was from The Middle and mm-hmm, from Raymond. And so the description of the show, this article I'm reading, gives a description of the show. And it says, well, it tells the story of a 50-year-old divorcee who decides to get into medicine and, you know, there's a new chapter in her life and blah, blah, blah. So I look at this and I say, there's no way Patricia Heaton is 50.
Right.
I'm like, there's no way she's 50. She's got to be almost 60.
Yeah. Probably.
You know, she has to be. There's just no question.
Yeah, for sure.
And it says that she and her husband are producing this show.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it says it's the story of a 50-year-old. So, I mean, you know, this is the way it's being sold. So what I love is at the early paragraph in the story, it explains the premise of the show. It's a 50-year-old divorcee. Later in the article, according to Heaton, 61.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm like, so Patricia Heaton already in her mind believes that she could pass for 50.
Well, you know, good for her. Hey, she does look good.
Oh, I know she does. But my point is, they earlier in the story said it's about a 50-year-old divorcee, and she's playing the 50-year-old divorcee. And then later in the story, we find out she's 61. I just found that kind of funny how, you know, she's producing the show. So in her mind, yeah.
Well, you know, if Michael Douglas in movies can be married to women who are like 40.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, that's but that's always
good for Patricia Heaton.
Oh, no. I just love how they don't say, you know, a 60-year-old woman.
Yeah.
They just they make it sound as if she's 50 in the show, even though later on we find out that she's 11 years older than that. So Hey, you know, like I said, no, believe me, she looks great. She looks great. In fact, the funny thing is in the story, it says, oh, you know, that she talks about how it's difficult in Hollywood to, you know, remain, you know, in shape and everything, you know, and look good. And then there's a quote from her that says, to all the young people out there, you know, eat whatever you want until you're 45, because after that, you're going to have to cut it all out.
Right. Well, she's been pretty upfront, I think, about some of the stuff she's had done.
She had some twins. I know she said she had a breast lift long, and you could, I mean, remember watching Raymond, and you could see when it happened.
Mm-hmm. I think she has talked about, like, she had a tummy tuck and stuff. Good, again, once again, good for her. I say, and good for her for being upfront about it and not making women think that it's realistic.
Right.
To not change at all, especially if, like, you have twins or whatever, and then, or magically change and, like, you know, without any smoke and mirrors right. involved or whatever. So good for her.
Girl power.
That's right. Girl.
You, good for her. And you,
see, once again, I have to point out, you have always been into female empowerment.
you root for love.
Yep.
And you say, good for her.
Yeah, good
you,
for her.
You go, girl. So, anyway, I don't know how we got on. Oh, yeah, so Shane Gillis is already lying about his age. So, anyway, he's going to be, I'm wondering, is he already the cast member with the shortest tenure?
I mean, I think he's already a footnote.
Yeah.
At this point.
I mean, at the very least, he's going to make history. But mm-hmm. if you don't know the background, so they announced this comedian named Shane Gillis to one of the new castmates for the 45th season of Saturday Night Live. And within 2 or 3 days, there was a huge controversy about some comments that he had made on a recent podcast a couple years ago. That were, racial slurs about Asians, both in name as well as in their accents. And somehow this surfaced. Someone, you know, brought this up and brought it out. Of course, the Twitter sphere went crazy. And talk about fat. I mean, we are in such a fast world today. He lost his job within 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, wow. There's not even any time to sit back and, you know, so, I mean, I guess my question to you is, you know, comments aside, I mean, there's no doubt he said these things and he doesn't deny say them. So there's no arguments there. But I guess my question to you is, are you surprised by the swiftness of this? And once again, as we've seen over the last couple of years, is this the way we really want to do things in terms of people's livelihoods and their careers with this kind of swiftly, you know, this social media storm, if it really is one, to completely obliterate somebody's career in a minute?
Well, I mean, listen, there's a lot of people commenting on this right now. In fact, actually, I watched a clip of, David Spade has a show now on Comedy Central, and he had a couple of comedians on. Jim Jeffries, I think, was one of them, and I didn't even recognize the other guy. But it's interesting because David Spade, you know, he kicked off his show the other night, like their panel discussion just on this story. And he said, like, well, as a former cast member, I'm going to stay out of the fray here and just let you guys comment on this, which is probably very smart of David Spade. But, you know, a lot of people are defending this. I think, from my point of view, am I surprised at the swiftness? Not really. I mean, this is the world that we live in now. You know, things that you say are out there, and they, if you say them in any type of media forum, like, that is captured, it lives on, you know, in the internet. Now, these comments, I mean, one thing I will say is people talking about, oh, everyone's digging in his past. Is this how we're going to be now? In his, you know, in his history. I'm like, this is not history. It was 1 year ago. It was 1 year ago. So it was not that long ago. It's not like we look back to something the guy did in 1989 and decided, well, that, you know, that by today's standards, that's unacceptable. So therefore, you're fired. You know, that's not what's happening here. You know, not that anything like this was really acceptable back then, but you know, there were, I do think that people now, we know more now, you know, like people are smarter. People are, you know, I think we see the error of our ways from like how things used to be done anyway, but that's neither here nor there. Cause this was 1 year ago. I mean, I personally think that the people who are coming to his defense are not really making much sense to me, you know, because they're saying things like, you know, it's the old, well, comedians have to be able to push boundaries line, you know, and sometimes we misfire. Well, yeah, that is true. But I mean, like pushing boundaries doesn't have to mean saying things that are racist and homophobic and, you know, misogynistic, which I think he's like, there were a bunch of things that were said that fall under those categories. I mean, the second thing is like, you know, I guess the point is like, this isn't like he bombed on stage and someone revealed that to the world and now he's being fired. That's not the same thing, right? Like, don't you think?
You're wrong.
No,
Saturday Night Live breath. No, I see what you're saying. Here's my only problem with this is that I agree with you in that, you know, that this is the world we live in and you should know what's going on now. I guess my only problem with it is why isn't he allowed to either apologize, evolve, and say, look, you know what? I did say that, and I now see the error of my ways, and I apologize, and I was trying to be funny, and he has sort of said that I was trying to be funny, it didn't work, blah, blah, blah. I just think that we are, it's really easy. And I have no vested interest in Shane Gillis. I don't even know who he is. But it's real easy to cast this guy aside so quickly because we don't really have any, you know, equity in him. You know, nobody really knows who he is. Nobody really a fan of his. I just see a double standard in that there have been people who we like over the last couple of years who have said these things, Kevin Hart, and he's been allowed to apologize and go on.
Yeah, but Kevin Hart also lost a job over the
I understand that,
said.
But he's going to keep...
And wait, can I just point out...
But he's going to keep
though,
making movies.
We have to take a step back. He didn't really apologize. Let me tell you what his apology said. I can read it to you. This is what he...
Okay, well then even worse.
It feels ridiculous. I'm quoting Shane Gillis's Twitter feed. It feels ridiculous for comedians to be making serious public statements, but here we are. I'm a comedian who was funny enough to get SNL. That can't be taken away. Of course, I wanted an opportunity to prove myself at SNL, but I understand it would be too much of a distraction. I respect the decision they made. I'm honestly grateful for the opportunity. I was always a mad TV guy anyway,
right.
End quote. Okay. That is like...
Well, he's not apologizing. He's not apologizing because now he lost the gig. My point is he didn't get a chance. They fired him. He didn't get a chance to say, I'm sorry. If they would have said to him, look, you've got to come out here and do the mea culpa and do the walk of shame, but we want you to apologize, and then we're going to see how that flies. And if you sound... authentic and genuine, and this is authentic and genuine, then we'll take a look. But they just said, well, oh dear, seven people are complaining on Twitter. This is trending and this is too controversial for us. And so we're letting you go.
I agree. And I see that, but I also, I mean, again, I don't feel like there was any real attempt to apologize. I mean, again, even before he actually got fired, in the 2 days between,
well, we don't know
he was
that.
Fired, everything blew up, and then he got fired. he, again, it was like a lot of rhetoric about, I'm a comedian, I push boundaries, sometimes I miss. I mean, once again, that needs to stop being the party line for people, whether they're comedians or not, to say things that, you know, and lately when comedians get in trouble, this is kind of their go-to, you know, message, which is, hey, I'm a comedian. This is so part of the gig.
Well, then here's my question, though. Then what do I make? Well, then what can I mean, I'm not defending racial slurs or misogynistic comments. But I guess my point is, are you know, at the end of it, ultimately, isn't comedy making fun of something?
But it is, but you can make fun of a lot of things without being offensive or racist. I mean, I...
No, no, and honestly, I understand
like,
that.
Like, Jerry Seinfeld has made a career out of that. And by the way, that doesn't mean Jerry Seinfeld doesn't ever do anything provocative. Do comedians need to push limits? Yes, they do. But, like, taking him as an example, look at... Remember the Seinfeld episode, The Contest? I mean, that was massively pushing boundaries. It was hilarious. It's gone down as, like, you know, a classic Seinfeld episode, and he didn't have to offend anyone.
No, no.
He didn't have to be racist. He didn't have to be misogynistic. He didn't have to be any of those things to push boundaries and still be funny.
Well, here's the one thing that I found interesting. So, you know, this was, so they swiftly fired him. He's off the show and he's gone. And what was ironic too, was that in the midst of hiring him, they also made a big deal about the fact that they hired the first Asian castmate.
Well, and this is why I believe this came to light in the first place, which, again, a lot of comedians who are defending him are also turning to this whole, like, oh, great. So now every time somebody does something, we're going to run out and dig up a bunch of stuff on them so that they can get fired and whatever. That's not really what this is about. And I want to say that the person, or at least like based on some of the stuff I've read about this thing, I feel like the person who tweeted, I don't know if they tweeted at SNL with the like reference to this podcast that he had recorded with the comments that are, you know, at the center of this. But the person basically was making the point that, like, wow, it seems a little weird that when you guys are, like, announcing your very first, like, Asian American cast member, you are also announcing a cast member who has been totally racist towards
right.
that culture. And, you know, and I think the person was not sort of being like, all right, I'm going to go ruin this guy's life. It was more pointing out, like, the weird... almost like not, I don't, hypocrisy is not really the right word, but well, this irony, the irony that this is what's happening here, you know?
No, I get it. I guess, like, for instance, here, when I'm talking about not having equity in this guy, I think it was very easy for them to fire him. It was very easy to make a case against him. Because there is no feel, you know, the great amount of people don't really know and have a feeling for or against him. But so here's my example, and maybe this works, maybe it doesn't, but it just happened. I just saw this within the last week, which I found interesting in the midst of this, and this was recorded before this happened. So they did on Comedy Central, they did a roast of Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
And so it was very funny roast. There's some really good stuff. In fact, if you have a chance to see it, it's on Comedy Central. They're rerunning it quite a bit. I would watch it for the simple reason. Watch how great, and I don't know who wrote her the jokes, but Ireland Baldwin, his daughter, is fantastic.
I saw a clip of her.
Yeah, she had the best. I mean, she did not, you know, she did not hold back at all on their relationship and on the. You know, comments that he made, you know, about 10 or 12 years ago when he called her a pig, which, once again, if that happened in today's world, Alec Baldwin is kicked out of Hollywood. No questions asked. No questions asked. And what I think it's funny is that we don't kick Alan. I mean, once again, why is, and I've got to talk about something else, but right there, just for those comments alone about a woman and about his daughter and about a teenage daughter at the time, why has Alec Baldwin been able to resurrect his career? Why wasn't he kicked out of show business? Or why doesn't that come back to haunt him anymore? Why is that a form of a joke right now as opposed to something serious?
Right.
I mean, I don't know, because we like Alec Baldwin. And here's my example too. So here's what he said, you know, in the roast, all these people come up and they, you know, comically denigrate the subject, and then the subject comes back and says things about them. So the Asian actor, what's his name? Kevin, he was in The Hangover. You know what I'm talking about? The guy that's the doctor.
Yeah, I do. I forget his name. Yeah.
So Ken Jeong or something. I don't know what his name is.
I'll look it up.
Do you have that internet machine with you?
I'm just gonna jump on the information superhighway.
Click on your internet machine and see if you can find his name. It's Ken something.
Oh yeah, it is. It's Ken Jeong.
Yeah. So he was,
you were right.
Yeah, well, you know, well, that's
right.
Hello. So so he roasted, you know, he did his little shtick on Alec Baldwin. So now Alec Baldwin comes on to, you know, make comments about all the people on the dais. So he makes a comment about Ken Jeong, and I don't know the entire setup, but basically the joke was, you know, Ken, blah, 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 because I know it's difficult for you to say Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, no. Come on.
Now, he said that. Now, how is that? Now, and everybody laughed, and Ken Jeong was, you know, standing up and laughing. You know, he was doing a whole Sammy Davis Jr. kind of thing, overly laughing, even though I'm sure it, you know, that's what Sammy did. When Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra would make utterly racist comments, Sammy would laugh like he thought it was so funny, which is kind of sad. And that's what this Ken Jeong did. And so that is clearly a racist joke about the accents of Asians, of which this Shane Gillis is being accused of saying something about Asian accents.
Well, he doesn't know. I mean, have you heard a clip of the podcast? I mean, he goes on and on and on and on. And it's not just this one podcast either. I mean, there are other.
I'm not defending him.
And I know I'm not saying the Comedy Central joke is right either, but I mean.
But my point is, how come I didn't even hear anything? I didn't hear any uproar about this at all. This is my point. Either we're going to have a level playing field and we're going to have zero tolerance, which is what some people want. And so if there's zero tolerance, then that to me is an even playing field. Now everybody knows the rules, and then you shouldn't be upset if something happens to you because you went against that rule. But we have no rules. It is purely subjective. I think it depends on who says it or when they say it, or as you said about the context of it, the irony that, you know, they are announcing the first Asian cast member, and then their other cast member is on the record making Asian jokes. I understand this. I'm not defending this guy at all.
Right.
But I'm just once again kind of bothered in that we're seeing people. There is a rush to judgment on some. And then other people, for whatever reason, I mean, all I have to say is I still say right now in Virginia, the governor is still there. And he wore blackface, or maybe he didn't. But how is that? How is he still in office? And Al Franken had to resign.
Well, I mean, that because you have to ask their constituents. Yeah, you know, well, that
but my point is, I'm just
how,
saying
that's
is that
how they are where they are or taken out.
I mean, I remember hearing in the midst of this about, you know, several months ago that Morgan Freeman had some sexual assault allegations put against him.
Harassment.
And they just went away. Yeah. They just went away.
Well,
now why? Because we love Morgan Freeman's voice.
Well, you know what, though? Maybe it is a case like nobody knows who Shane Gillis is. This guy just came in off the street, you know? So, no.
But that bothers me is that
people aren't as forgiving, I guess, because they're not attached to him.
But that bothers me because there's this poor guy. And like I said, I'm not defending him. But all I know is that whether he's a racist, homophobic, or he's a boundary bending, comedian, he could be either one or both. But all I do know is that for him to have gotten to a point to have been able to even audition for Saturday Night Live, as well as get the gig, he had to go through a lot of work. He clearly must have some talent. I haven't heard his comedy, so I can't judge on that. But my point is, this guy gets the break of a lifetime, whether he deserved it or not. He went through all the hoops and all the hurdles that it takes to get there, and he actually got it. And then, whether he made a mistake or not, I don't think he got a reasonable chance to get a chance to apologize. And I am very surprised by Saturday Night Live, of all people, of all institutions, that has been around for 45 years because of the fact that it broke new ground and stretched boundaries and pushed the envelope and did and said things that were, I mean, you know, you can go back and you can, and if you want to keep, and like you said, which is a good point, this wasn't 20 years ago. This was 2 weeks ago. But, you know, you look at some of the things Saturday Night Live has done over the last 45 years. They couldn't do that today.
Well, right. And that's the thing, too, like, because Jim Jefferies brought this up on the David Spade show, and he was using SNL itself as an example of, you know, he was talking about, like, some of the sketches Jim Belushi used to do when he was, like, the samurai guy.
Right. Now, how isn't that racist?
Mike Myers. But again, I mean, that was decades ago, and we do know better now. And the reality is SNL wouldn't put that sketch on today.
Well, I don't. But my point is that you became SNL because of that. So that's a part.
True.
That's a part of your history. That's a part of your legacy. And this wouldn't even be a big deal, because SNL wouldn't be around if it wasn't for those kind of sketches that, to your point, I understand, at the time, that wasn't viewed as, socially unacceptable.
Right. Well, but that's the thing is, like,
I mean, I watched I watched the samurai thing. I was 10 years old when that was on, and, you know, 10 or 11, 12 years old. I never viewed that for an instant like it was racist at the time. Nobody did. Nobody thought that was racist, even though John Belushi through that whole thing was just going, that was the whole bit.
Yes, but now we know.
I understand that. But my point is, I just, you know, to have Saturday Night Live not even give this guy the benefit of the doubt for a second to be able to at least do the walk of shame. And then if that plays or not, then they could decide. But wow, to me it was like, you know what, you said this and we can't have it and there's zero tolerance. It's like, wow, this is coming from an establishment that is known for breaking the rules, which went out, which basically defined itself.
Right. But I think it's that, like, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is you can break rules and you can push boundaries and you can be edgy and you can do those things without offending people, being racist, you know? So I think that's where SNL is at right now. It's like, you need to be able to be funny and be edgy without doing things like that. You know, you just don't have to. And you know, like, it's interesting because a lot of the people coming out publicly defending him are actually former SNL cast members. Norm MacDonald tweeted support to him and said, I know the process you've just been through. I know how hard it is.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
To get that spot. And, but then the other thing is, like, it's weird because, like, Rob Schneider, remember him?
Yeah. Yeah, the copy guy. Stingorama. Stingling a ding dong. Sting.
Right. He initially came out kind of saying, like, you know, as a former SNL cast member, I'm sorry that, you know, this is what he said. He said, I'm sorry that you had the misfortune of being a cast member during this era of cultural unforgiveness where comedic misfires are subject to the intolerable inquisition of those who never risk bombing on stage themselves, end quote. But then the weird thing is, then he seemed to, like, backpedal, because then he posted something on his Twitter that he tweeted directly at Shane Gillis. And he said, last thought on this, there's a difference between exposing truths through free speech and just being ugly. It's not okay to say racist things under the guise of comedy. Just because you have a mic in your hand doesn't make the racist things you say any less racist. So that's interesting.
So clearly somebody got to him.
Something happened.
Yeah, somebody got to him. So whenever I hear the follow-up quote, I always take the first quote as what the person really believes.
Yeah.
And then the second one is after somebody got to them, their publicist or somebody, and said, if you ever want to work again, you better walk back from this. I mean, you know, we're hearing this all the time. A few weeks ago during the debates, I don't know if you saw them, but it was clear that that Julian Castro was making reference to Joe Biden being old he kept pounding on him, saying, have you just forgotten what you just said 2 minutes ago?
Oh, geez.
Have you forgotten what you just said? So it was clear that he was making an inference to Joe Biden being old and possibly having dementia. And then, of course, everybody reacted to that. And then the next day, he and Cory Booker and others, well, now look, it's like, no, that's what you did. And you and I both worked in public relations. We know the game.
Right.
You know, we would sit there.
Well, but
that's
also part of the SNL thing. It's like, it is like they needed, they needed to deal with this swiftly one way or the other. And that's the route they took. I mean, I think, you know, if this were, I mean, it, again, to your point, if this were, I think the way that they're dealing with it is probably, you know, they're looking at this specific case, right? And you know, he's new to the cast. They just announced him. No one really even knows who he is yet.
Yeah.
Now, if this were, I have to think with SNL, if this were a cast member who's been with, like, let's say Kenan Thompson, who's been with them forever. If someone dug something up from even a year ago, or I would hope it would, you know. But
you
whatever.
Know that they would have given him a chance.
If they dug up something that he said that was offensive, yeah, I have a feeling, yes, they would. Maybe would deal with it differently, or it would take them a little more time to figure out what they were going to do.
Was very easy and simple, but at the same time, I wonder if this guy, and as I said, I'm not defending him, and I don't know this guy, I would probably... probably wouldn't like his humor. I don't know that, but based on what I've seen and what I've heard, I probably wouldn't like it. But I just think this guy got the short shrift on things. And here's the other thing: if you want to do this, then I think at the very least, there's no question that this would have been a distraction.
Yeah,
the first show would have been all about this guy, and so it I mean, I understand their reasoning, but at the very least, then I would have hoped. I would have thought, I don't know if this ever came up, at the very least, unless he balked at it, I don't know the back behind the stage machinations of this, but at the very least, you know what? Wouldn't have been even better then to at least say, to give this guy a chance to resign? You know what I mean? To say, you know what? To let him give his apology and to say, you know what? I made these mistakes. I apologize. I said these things. I am and if he wanted to continue with his other line of, look, I'm a comedian. I'm just trying to be funny. Sometimes the jokes aren't good. I push boundaries. I am sorry for being insensitive. And because I don't want to be a distraction, because I respect the institution of Saturday Night Live, even though I did make it and it was my dream to do it, I respectfully resign in deference to the show, and thank you for the opportunity that I had.
Why would Lorne Michaels do that? Lorne Michaels fired Adam Sandler and Chris Rock when they were at their peak on that show. Why would he be like?
To your point, it's a different time. We're in a different time here. Because
no,
I'm just saying,
I don't think this guy owes anything.
But you know what? You hired him. So yeah. for 2 days, you thought this guy was part of your family. And so, if this was someone who you were just deciding about and was still in the audition process, then he wasn't a part of the family. But you, when you made that announcement, you christened this person, and you, in that moment now, he can, in all rights, refer to himself as former Saturday Night Live cast member.
Well, yeah, with like yes. the shortest tenure. Well,
regardless.
I guess, though, the point too about that is, I mean, they owned up to not having really fully vetted him. And I think that probably does bring into question, like, I mean, yes, they have their process. And over time, over the years, many cast members have talked about and have been asked about, you know, the whole process of auditioning for SNL. And then when they finally get that audience with Lorne Michaels and how nerve-wracking that is that. And, you know, I've heard lots of them tell their, you know, story of being cast over the years. And it's always really interesting to hear. And so there is a process that takes place. But I suppose now maybe this is a wake-up call, too, for SNL, that they've got to have somebody on staff, especially because this is a podcast that was like a year ago. This is not something that he said on stage that someone happened to record on their mobile phone 15 years ago. You know what I mean? So, like, maybe they should have, like, he's being cast on the show. Maybe they should be listening to his podcast. Maybe they should be, you know, checking out, like, any...
Well, they will from now on. Now that you say that, I just remember that before he even started, or just right after he started, perhaps, but I think it was even before, the guy who hosts, on Comedy Central, Trevor Noah.
Yeah,
he was plucked out of obscurity, and soon after he was hired, they found some racist things, but Comedy Central stood by him. And he weathered the storm, and now he's the guy. Right. So I this is my point. This is such a gray area, and it seems like we're making up the rules as we go along, and depending on who it is, and if we like them or if we might like them. And as I said, here, White Comedy Central could have bailed out on this guy. On Trevor Noah, but they didn't. Yeah. And now he's accepted, and everybody forgets he said those things, and we're off to the races. And he apologized.
Oh, I know. Okay. I didn't even know what he said, but I did read in just the coverage about this specific incident. People were bringing up the Trevor Noah thing, which at the time that happened, I was not aware
yeah,
of it.
So I just bothers me in that, you know, I just don't like hypocrisy, and I don't like unfairness. And I just think that in a grand scheme of things, I'm not going to the wall for this guy. I don't know, as I said before, if he's a racist or he's a homophobe. I'm not defending him, but I really do believe that our process is highly flawed on this. And you know, whether it's Supreme Court justices or whether it's comedians or whether it's actors, I'm not seeing any kind of here's the rule. We are this is becoming very biased on where someone is, on who it is. Now, I'm just wondering too, everybody said, and I just read this too. And once again, I'm not defending anything, but they said that they actually hired this guy because he's more of a conservatively bent comedian.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. People thought that was part of the motivation for them hiring him, is that they're
right,
trying
because
to get
they,
a more conservative
Yeah, because
audience.
The show
or
seems...
Not get it,
no,
to get
just to even the balance.
Audience. They're trying to attract more audience members from...
Well, they're trying to balance the fact because they're so far to the right, too far to the left with doing all the Trump stuff, that the show looks like it's completely biased to the left.
Well, so, that's not just a Trump thing. They've always been like that.
Oh, yeah, but the Trump stuff.
Norm MacDonald used to do Bob Dole.
Oh, yeah, no, there's no question. But my point is, right, in the last few years, with all the anti-Trump thing, the show has become very, you know, that's the image. So they wanted to get a conservative guy. So now my question is, was the justice, you know, so swift on this guy? Because he is more conservative.
No, I really don't think.
Well,
so.
I don't know. If he was more liberal, would there have been more of a understanding or less of a swift thing? I don't know. I'm just bringing these up because that now has to be put into the whole pot of examining this case because it was so fast. And it seemed like there was very little, struggle on this. It was like, people on Twitter are screaming. We don't want to upset them. Fire him.
I think it's more your point about the fact that he was not there was no attachment to him. I don't think it has to do with whether.
Yeah.
He was
well, like I said, I don't. We're not going to decide this because there is no. There is no right way to decide it, right or wrong. But I just think it's interesting to talk about it, and it's interesting to hear different angles because, sadly, I don't think this is the end. We're going to hear, we may never hear of Sean Gillis again, but
Shane. So you're already getting his name wrong.
Well, does it matter?
Right, you're right. We will never hear from Sean Gillis again.
But I don't think it's the last time we're going to hear. About someone kind of being, tried and found guilty in the court of public opinion so quickly. I don't think this is just something now that is part of our society because of the impact of social media. And I just pray that what the hell was that? That we don't.
Are you hearing things now?
Yeah, what's all that noise you're making?
I'm not making any noise.
Oh, you didn't hear I thought you were getting dressed or something.
No, I'm not. That noise is not here.
Really?
You have something.
Oh, I heard like a whoosh. No?
No, I didn't hear that.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's just the voices in your head,
Jim. Well, the voices.
Now I'm starting to get a little worried about you.
Well, the voices in my head are telling me that it's time to go. So once again, Emily, thank you so much for your insights and your opinions. And just make sure you don't say anything too controversial or I'll have to fire you.
You know what? I am going to try. Listen, we got to watch what we say on this podcast.
Oh, I know.
Well, this is a podcast.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know anybody's listening, but at the same time, it is out there. So someone can go back and find this.
All I can say is if you can get fired for loving American Horror Story, then we are probably in big trouble.
Right,
but
exactly.
But otherwise, yeah, I think, I guess that's the whole thing. Yeah. It's like stuff can come back. Everything comes back.
Yeah, no, you have to. You have to be very careful.
Everyone makes mistakes. That's true. Everyone makes mistakes. But not everybody says things that are
racist, like I said,
or homophobic.
It's a gray area. I just wish that he wasn't fired within 2 days. It just seemed like somebody's complaining. Once again, nobody cares who he is. Let's get rid of him. I just think people, whether you like him or not, whether we know who he is or not, the guy clearly made the grade, and he had what it took to get. To make it on Saturday Night Live. That's no small task. And so I just think that there needs to be a little more deliberation. I guess that's my only, the biggest problem I have with this is that it was very swift. And in today's world, everybody just, lines up on one side or the other. And there's very little discourse and very little deliberation. And it's just like, okay, goodbye. And meanwhile, the guy looks around and goes, holy cow. One day I just was on top of the world, and the next day I'm a pariah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Well, you know what? When my skeletons come back popping up, you'll think about it for a whole week before you fire me.
Oh, well, we will. I'll dig for those skeletons, and we'll see if Emily is back next week or not.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. And don't say anything bad about Asians.
Oh, jeez. Just quit while you're ahead.
You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Thank you so much for doing whatever it is you do to find us, downloading, scrolling, clicking, on whatever platform you do find us on. As I said many times here, don't be afraid to subscribe to that platform and rate this podcast, and by all means, spread the word. Let everybody know about Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And of course, always posted every Monday at WGNplus.com. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen. I'll have two egg rolls and a beef fried rice. Thank you.